Hello and welcome. I've got some questions and comments from Elise, which I'm going to try and address this evening. But if anybody else has got anything that they want to ask or rant about, feel free, go right ahead. Nothing immediately? Okay. Well, Elise, do you mind if I talk about your email?
Please do, yes, thank
you. Okay, fine. Well, she's finding the stories difficult to interpret, assimilate, and buy into. And I absolutely get that. It's very difficult to understand these stories without having quite a deep knowledge of the social structures of the time. And just to start off with, the world beginning did believe in matriarchal divinity. And things were probably a great deal better for women in those days because nobody knew where the babies came from. They hadn't actually worked out that it was the whole, you know, what was going on. Everybody was probably having sex and then some babies came along, but sometimes when they had sex, babies didn't come along. So you don't know exactly how they worked these things out. But once it became apparent that a baby came when a man had intercourse with a woman, the world changed. Because once we had started putting up fences to start with, we were herders and we hunted. We had cattle that we herded, but we were nomads because we hadn't learned how to live on the land and how to grow things. That was the second development of humanity. And it was the reason why we could breed in vast numbers and expand our population. And that's when we started putting up fences. And in the beginning, when you were herding, then everybody was valuable, everybody was important, and especially the children and those who were perhaps pregnant, who would be doing foraging for the foods that we needed. And they were the ones who fed the tribe. The hunt was pretty much a special occasion because most hunters that went out to hunt wouldn't catch anything. So they'd come home and they'd eat what had been gathered by the foragers. As we then started herding cattle, we started thinking we might have to have fences. And then if we were staying in one place, we thought that we would put fence, you know, till the ground. However, up until then, and this is to a certain amount of speculation, but I've read as many books as I possibly can about what was going on in these ancient days. When we were herding and moving, a woman's life was as valuable as a man's, but a child's life was not, because the woman could always have more children and the woman was required, needed, to nurture the children that were there. So if your child fell in the river, you would not necessarily jump into the river to save your child, because that meant you might die and your other six children would then almost certainly die. Once we got fences and fields, we wanted workers in the field. Therefore, the children became more important than the mother. Having a large group of people to work the fields was more important than the one person who gave birth to them, because she could be replaced, quite possibly with the eldest daughter. And that was the start of what we would call patriarchy, which was when we fenced ourselves. And as soon as we start to fence ourselves, we start to think that we own things and we don't necessarily work in harmony with the other, because the other could threaten our crops. And the matriarchal faith lasted for longer than in the further east you went. But once we got to the first temple of Judaism, the matriarchal was totally honoured. It was honoured at the same level as the male, and I believe that men and women were probably treated as relatively equal then. But that wasn't when the Torah was written down. History is written by the winners. And we also have to remember, and it's quite hard to realise how different the world was before the late 1950s when the pill was invented. Until then, a woman really did not have autonomy over her own body. She couldn't really say, I don't want to have children. And even in the 1960s, the pill was readily available for women in the UK in 1960. But it wasn't until 1967 that an unmarried woman could have it. And before then, even a married woman had to have her husband's permission to have it. You know, so actually the oppression, if you want, or suppression of the feminine has gone on for generation after generation after generation. And we really can't expect the written Torah to show us anything different from that. What we can do is understand that the best criticism of the bad is the practice of the better. And now we have to update this and reinterpret it, which is what I did with the book A Woman's Worth, and look at it again and see what gems we can get. And I can tell you that in the wisdom books of the Bible, the divine feminine is absolutely prevalent all the way through if you know how to find it. So the old teaching was pretty much equal. But then came the destruction of the first temple, the Babylonian exile, and the understanding that there were other religions which had a lone god making the world. So therefore, it became fashionable. And again, history is written by the winners. So how did it happen? Well, it happened over generation, and it happened over through agriculture, basically. Agriculture was probably the cruelest thing that humanity did to the planet because we started thinking we owned it. Up until then, we didn't. Yes, Sally, you got your hand up.
Hi, yeah, and also the mistranslations. So the versions that we have, as you know, Maggie,
No, thank you. It's a good point. I'd have forgotten to make
it. The pre-Septuagint texts are so different from the Septuagint, and then the post-Council of Nicaea texts, which are the main texts that we have, are absolutely radically different from the original.
Yes.
And the Asherah and Ish and Isha are all the way through the masculine and the feminine, and the feminine is largely eradicated with the Greek or hidden in plain sight.
Yeah.
With mistranslation.
Yep.
And then the other thing, I can remember, because Kabbalah and Exodus is such an amazing book by Warren, and what finally kind of persuaded me that there's so much in the stories is that each operates in each of the worlds. So
yes, and
doing the Yetzeratic version of Exodus, which possibly you'll take us through, when you realise that the Exodus story isn't about other people, it's about it's completely an internal journey looking at psychological aspects of yourself.
Yeah.
And it becomes such a different set of texts to work.
Yes, I think you'll enjoy Exodus a lot more than Genesis, to be honest. And it's the same with the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation is a Merkabah ascent. It's an internal journey to destroy the negativity within us. But of course, it's been written, set in stone, that it's the end of the world and the coming of the beast.
Go on. The descriptions of the feminine in Revelations, which is written in the Greek originally, I think, actually echo the Gospel of St. John and Joshua. And so Joshua 2:5 has the exact line that describes, and the Greek translation is, you know, that the children will be killed because of the harlot. But the original Greek is original Hebrew. It's a totally different translation.
Well, that's also true. But the harlot, if you read Revelation the way Margaret Barker is interpreting, the harlot was the Second Temple.
The divine feminine completely, you know, that's the history of the translation of the word harlot itself. And all the way through Joshua with that mistranslation, when actually she's an initiator rather than a...
We're going to meet the harlot tonight. Well, we're not. We're going to meet somebody who got called a harlot. But anyway. Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. Sorry.
But I love it now. And Elise, when I started, I was like, what?
Yes.
I've had a Church of England education.
Yes. Me too. Me too. Once you start going into it, you've got to unravel a lot of shit, pardon my French, before you can actually see, oh, it is there and it's hidden and maybe it's meant to be hidden. Maybe it's so sacred that it should not be laid out, as Jesus said, don't cast pearls before swine. And also we have to also understand two more things, one of which Kabbalah believes in reincarnation. So we were back there repressing women. We women were back there as men oppressing women at some point, so we contributed, and also we still contribute by supporting patriarchy in any way, shape or form. And I don't mean patriarchy to be negative to men. There are some lovely men, two of whom are on this course, but and one of whom I'm married to, and one of whom is my best friend. But women do actually not help themselves an awful lot, and you have to admit that Sarah, Hagar, Leah and Rebecca and Rachel didn't behave very well either. But I'm afraid we're going to come across a really, really horrible story next, which is Dinah. But we have to look at it, and therefore, so we shall. Are you ready to share the screen? Okay, good. Okay, so tonight we're going to be looking at the scapegoats. One of them wins, one of them loses. And yes, you can guarantee that you know which one of them wins and which one of them loses. But we're talking about Dinah and we're talking about Joseph. But let's have a quick look at Torah. Torah means teaching. It's interpreted usually as law, but it means teaching. The divine Torah is at Atzilut, the top world of the Tree of Life. And that Torah comes through in the Old Testament, the New Testament, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the teachings of Buddha. It's the source of the divine teaching, and it comes through in the form that is needed for people. At the level of Berea, which is the blue world there, that's the mystical teaching, which equates to the sapphires that Moses wrote the teaching on. They were transparent and reflected the blue of the sky. So these are mostly the oral teachings, and they flow and adapt and update and can be discussed. And the third level at Yetzirah, which is the purple world, is the law. It's for those who need discipline and guidance, but it's oral and written. And you see this in the yeshivas in Israel and places where even though it's written down, it can still be debated. There's still a certain level of flow in it. And it's okay to say, but what about this and how about that? And I don't get the other. And in a way, that's what we're doing because I'm telling you things and hopefully you're asking me things. But we can debate them, disagree with them, and that's absolutely fine. And finally, down in Asiya, which is the red-pink world at the bottom there, it's set in stone, which means it becomes more law than spirit. And that's basically kindergarten religion. The biggest problem the world has today around religion is it kindergarten religion, which is, I read it in a book, therefore it's true. And we can see this, I read it on the internet, therefore it's true. I saw it on Google, therefore it's true. And we are very prone to not doing the depth of the research ourselves, but just looking for what Brian McLaren calls confirmation bias. This is what I was taught. I need to find evidence that it's true. So the written teaching is always dangerous because it's used by people who need to be right. And the Torah that we have written down, which has got amazing and wonderful things in, is the text of tribe. It's setting the foundation. It's setting the yesod of humanity. And it works, the Bible, Hebrew Testament works from this vital process of order, disorder, reorder. That's how we learn things. We have to have structure and identity, then we have to rebel, and then we reorder. That's the whole purpose of the hero's journey, as Joseph Campbell put it, which is if we have a strong, solid foundation, we have to react against it in order to grow up. And this is how the Old Testament, sorry, Hebrew Testament is structured. Torah is the identity of the people through the law, the tradition and the structure. And that's order. We need that to start with. One of the reasons why we have so many fundamentalists in the world at the moment is because they were raised in a time when they weren't given boundaries and structure the way we younger ones who were born in the 1950s and before were given. We are actually more free to experiment because we had a solid foundation. If you don't have a solid foundation, your ego is going to seek one, and that can lead you very easily into fundamentalist teaching where you feel safe, because without a boundary, a child does not feel safe. The prophets are the disorder. They're the stumbling stones. They're where we get it horribly wrong, but they're the ones where we have the criticism of ourselves and the other. And the prophets are constantly saying, no, no, no. And my favourite bit in Samuel is when the people go to Samuel, who's very old and going to die soon and whose son is not going to be the next prophet, and they say, we need a king. We need a king. And Samuel goes to the Lord and says, they say they need a king. And the Lord says, tell them they really don't want a king. So Samuel goes back and says, you don't want a king. And they go, we need a king, we need a king. So he goes back and says, they really want a king. And the Lord says, if tell them that if they have a king, he will put their young man into slavery, make their daughters harlots, and will lead you into war. You do not want a king. And Samuel goes back to the people and goes, you don't need a king. And they go, we want a king. Everybody else has got a king. We want a king. So Samuel goes back to the Lord, and the Lord says, fine, you can have a king then. It's very clear warning. It's not what you want. You do not want an absolute monarch. And then finally, we've got the wisdom text, these things like Proverbs and the Song of Solomon. And there's a certain amount of wisdom text in some of the prophets, but Proverbs is the one that has the divine feminine all the way through it. And they are about mystery and paradox and inclusivity. And that is the new reorder. And the role of Jesus coming was to try and bring another disorder. And the role of people like St. Paul was to bring another reorder. And of course, as we've been talking about the law of three in the Tuesday night group, unless you have a clear impulse, your reorder will become corrupted. And unfortunately, that happens in every single religion because it becomes based on control and power instead of transformation. It becomes transactional. You do this, you're good, you'll go to heaven. You do that, you're bad, you'll go to hell. Whereas transformation is about getting you to an individual one-to-one relationship with the Holy One. So let's have a quick look at the position of women. This is around the time of Jesus. And we celebrate democracy, but democracy was invented by the Greeks, who were the biggest oppressors of women of all the nations in those days. Democracy in Greece meant as long as you were a free man. Apart from Sparta, the women were not free. I remember being in terrible trouble at school because we were taught about Athens and Sparta. And we were told to write an essay on which of the cities we would prefer to live in. My best friend Joe and I wrote that we wanted to live in Sparta because the girls were allowed to fight and ride horses and live their own lives. And the teacher was absolutely furious with us because Athens was the seat of democracy. But we weren't taught back then that that did not include the women, but it clearly didn't. A Greek woman in Jesus's time was not allowed out of her home without escort from her father or her husband. She simply didn't go. It wasn't safe and it wasn't allowed. And Roman women didn't go out alone, but they were allowed out as long as they had a slave, male slave or a male relative to protect them. Roman and Jewish women could act as regents for their sons. They could handle money. And Jewish women actually had the right to refuse entry to their home, to their husband. They had the right to expect pleasure on the eve of the Sabbath when they were supposed to have sex. If a husband did not pleasure his wife, he was at fault and she could ask for a divorce. And Jewish women could own property and they could even be presidents of synagogues. So in fact, even though we're writhing in agony at what's going on for these Jewish women, they still had a lot more rights than most of the women in the world in those days. The book Women and Religion in the First Christian Centuries by Deborah Sawyer is an excellent resource for finding out exactly what was going on around there. And just to divert, St. Paul's teaching that women couldn't teach in public, it looks terrible for us. But if you look at the social mores of the time, they had the cult of Magna Mater or the goddess Cybele in Rome at that time. Very powerful goddess, virgin mother of her son who was murdered and resurrected, Attis. And the Galli, who were the priests of Cybele, were self-castrated men who wore long flowing clothing and long flowing hair, which they wore loose. And certain elements of Rome thought they were an abomination, and the Galli were quite frequently struck down in the street and raped, because that was the way Roman males showed dominance over something, male rape. That's one of the things St. Paul is talking about too. Or they were murdered, and quite frequently they were raped to death. So a woman going out onto the streets and teaching about a virgin mother and a resurrected son would probably be mistaken for one of the priests of the Galli. So although we can't approve of it, you can actually start to see that maybe it was just the social mores of those times. And unfortunately, we're still in a world where women do not feel that safe going out on the street. And even at my age, I'm way past the age where anybody's going to automatically take one look at me and think, whoa, or want to have power over me. But I'm still slightly nervous at night walking along the street. And if a man shows up and starts walking behind me, I'll cross the street. We are not through all this yet. We really aren't. We have a long way to go. So, bearing all that in mind, let's get back to Genesis and the formation of the 12 tribes of Israel. There's only two tribes left that we know of. 10 of them became lost over the ages. But the 12 is important because it's one of those sacred numbers, and they're assigned places on the astrological zodiac, different places by different teachers. So those 12 on that slide are actually not all Jacob's sons. Two of them are sons of Joseph. Joseph is absent, his two sons take his place, and Levi is also absent because Levi was the priestly class. It was from the Levites that the Kohanim came. Levites were the ones who looked after the people's spiritual needs. So they didn't have time to farm. They didn't have their own land. Therefore, they were supported by the others, but they weren't territorial. So here's a quick look at the astrology of the tribes. This is the rabbinical tradition. It doesn't agree with the version that our teacher Zev Ben Shimon Halevi Warren Kenton did, and it doesn't agree with another version either. But that's the good thing about an oral tradition, because we could actually, if we knew about astrology, sit down for a week and debate it and enjoy it, if you're into that kind of thing, which I kind of am, but I know that's relatively sad. But in the tribes were placed in certain areas to the north, the south, the east and the west, and that's how people decided to place them on the tree. Simeon, Reuben and Gad in the south, Manasseh, Ephraim and Benjamin in the west, Asher, Dan and Naphtali in the north, and Judah, Issachar and Zebulun in the east. And the classical chart wheel is always calculated anti-clockwise rather than clockwise. Clockwise was another of those things that came in with the Babylonian exile, like 60 minutes to the hour. Good things and bad things come in. So let's talk about Dinah. Dinah's story is a tragedy. If you've read The Red Tent by Anita Diamond, she did her absolute best to bring resolution, revelation, and new life for Dinah, and I absolutely salute her for that. But the story in the Bible is fairly horrible. That, by the way, that diagram on the right is my placing of the women of the Hebrew Testament on the Tree of Life. It seems to work very well. There's more about it in A Woman's Worth. But Dinah is placed in the triad on the left-hand side, which is the triad of pain and guilt and suffering. It's not a bad triad, it's a triad of grief and sorrow, and we all go through grief and sorrow. But when it gets unhealthy, it's about holding on to wounds and holding on to debts and resentment and deep fear. And Dinah is not placed on the central column. Leah and Rachel aren't either, but they can balance each other out. But Dinah is in this triad on the left-hand side. Rahab, on the other hand, is on the right-hand side, and we'll talk about her later on during Exodus, even though she's featured more in Joshua. Dinah was Leah's daughter. Leah, the unloved. Leah's only daughter. And Dinah went out. She went out to see the daughters of the land. She would have been probably in her early teens. So she went out to visit other women, not of her tribe, other women. So she was an innovator. as Sally said earlier, innovation. So she was the first woman that we know of who went out as an independent woman. And then Sechem, who was a prince of the local principality, so I suspect she was going to see some of the people of his nation. And it says, he saw her, he took her and lay with her and defiled her. Notice again, we've got our four levels. He saw her, then he possessed her, and then he had sex with her, and by that sex he defiled her. Now, the judgment is in the defiling her, because it's come down to the physical world of law. And in those days, a woman who was not a virgin and wasn't married was a harlot and useless, of no value. But listen to this. His soul clave unto Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the damsel and spoke kindly from his soul to her. And he spoke to his father Hamor, saying, get me this damsel to wife. So, we don't know if this was rape, seduction, or consensual sex. We don't know. But we do know that rape is generally not anything to do with sexual attraction or love. It's a power game. It's a control thing. It has nothing to do with genuine passion. And there is very little evidence that Dinah was taken by force. The word Anna means humbled or spoilt. And a woman who'd had sex before marriage was technically in those days humbled or spoiled. It renders her useless unless the man wants to marry her. And no, I know it's horrific, but it was like that up to 100 years ago. And it still is like that in many parts of the world. So what happens is that Sechem really wants to marry this woman. He takes her back to the town where he lives. We don't know if that's coerced, but if a woman will go out on her own, she's showing she has spirit. So it's entirely possible that Dinah would have made his life an absolute misery and escaped. I think I'm going to go on the sign that she was actually okay with it. After all, she was the only girl, and she was the daughter of a mother who was not loved. Leah is known as Leah the Unloved. And if you're unloved, you can't teach your child how to love. My mother was unloved. And she ended up being a narcissist. She always said, I made quite sure that you didn't receive the same treatment that my mother gave me. But she still really, really needed the power over me. And it took me a long time to value myself. And if your mother can't teach you self-value because she has none herself, then you are going to allow pretty much any man who wants you to sleep with you because you don't know how to say no. I know this from my own past, and I've known this from another other women's past when they weren't taught self-esteem or self-respect. However, Sechem wants Dinah as a wife. And frankly, at that stage, the only hope for Dinah's life is to marry him. She's been rendered useless according to the law of the land. And Hamor, his father, gives Jacob, who is a passing itinerant herdsman, offers to share the land and to share husbands and wives. Basically, we can merge tribes. We can stop being the other. We can work together on this. My son loves your daughter. Let us celebrate this and merge our tribes. He said, make your price for the bride, because you had to pay a man for a woman if you wanted to marry her, which was ironic because it comes back to Elise's point that women are possessions of the men, but they were valuable enough to be worth money. And the gift I'm going to give you will be as big as you like. Only give me the girl as my wife. I'll give you whatever you want me. This is a man in love. And Jacob's sons answer. And they say, well, all right. They're not happy about it. But these sons go, well, all right, as long as you're circumcised. Because you can't join our tribe unless you're circumcised. And Sechem, you know, he's the crown prince, lost no time doing what they said because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. So all the men in this city accept circumcision, accept that they will merge with the other tribe. And when they're incredibly in pain, having had their foreskins removed, they're just go, they can't sit down either, I wouldn't have thought. On the third days, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Jairus' brothers, picked up their swords, went into the city and killed them all. And then they and their brothers sacked the city and took Dinah home. That is an act of terrorism. That is no better than what Vladimir Putin is doing in the Ukraine. That is an appalling, appalling piece of behaviour. And Jacob's terrified. Absolutely terrified. He can't understand at all how they could have done this. That's a picture from the TV series, The Red Tent. And they cannot understand how he probably, how could you brought trouble on me by making me a stench to the Canaanites. Basically, they've made him shameful by behaving in such an appalling factor. And he says, and he also says, for safety, we are very few in number. If they join forces against me and attack us, we'll be destroyed. And the boys just say, should he have treated our sister like a harlot? Actually, do you know, he didn't. To start with, he did. But he wanted to make her an honourable woman. And the action of those boys not only was traitorous to that village that wanted to be friends, it also did turn Dinah into a useless woman. No man would marry her after that. Well, perhaps a very elderly person who was desperate might marry her after that. But it's quite extraordinary how cruel this is to Dinah as well as to the others. So what happened to Dinah? Well, according to the customs of the time, she would have had to have been a servant to the rest of the family. She was unmarriable. She might have gone into prostitution and she might have gone into slavery. This was a culture where a man could divorce his wife the day after a marriage if she wasn't a virgin. So nothing good really comes from this story apart from there is karma. But the story also has to go into the story of Joseph before we talk about the karma. So if we look at the levels of interpretation there, we have an honour killing and a vendetta. We're still seeing these today in the Muslim world. We're still seeing these today in the mafiosi. We're still seeing these today in drug gangs. At the allegorical, it is about not being able to teach your daughter how to be loved or happy or how to say no. Leah, we know, stole Jacob. We don't know whether Leah did that on Laban's command, her father's command, but that's most likely. And Leah felt unappreciated, even though she had all the sons. She knew that Jacob didn't love her. And as she stole, her karma was that everything would be stolen from her daughter. And Dinah probably took what love she could get. And I will go back to my own story, which was I was a fair bit of a trollop when I was young, not because I wanted to be a trollop, but because I was so grateful that somebody wanted me. I'd never learnt when I was young that I was attractive or valued. And the only value I could put on myself was when a man wanted me. It's a very sad state of affairs, and it still exists in the world today. Metaphysically, well, this is about how we feel about the cost of stepping up or leaving the tribe. It is a scary thing to do. And Dinah was incredibly brave just to go out and have tea or whatever it was with the daughters of the land. And we lift this up to us, leaving the tribe, leading the family, doing anything that's out of the norm that's accepted for our family can be very scary and they don't like it. I was deeply amused today. My mother had a cabinet made for her by her father's work when she got married. And I always loved that cabinet. It's an absolutely beautiful piece of craftsmanship. And it had a secret drawer in it, which was my money box. And it was very special to me. And my mum died a year ago. And the one thing I said, I'd love to have the cabinet. My brother didn't want it, so I had the cabinet. We moved here, no room for it. no room for it anywhere, until I suddenly realised that even though it's a living room cabinet or a dining room cabinet, there's no reason why I can't have it in the bedroom, and I'll put all my ecumenical stuff in it. So today the cabinet went up on the wall, and I posted on Facebook about it, saying, interesting that the idea of where to put it only came once I'd let go of it. I was perfectly willing to give it away on Freegal or sell it and let go of this thing from my childhood because it was too important for my peace of mind that hanging on to it was not a good thing for me, and it was of no use. But having posted that I was really ridiculously pleased that it's up there and how nice it was, and it only happened because I let go of it, my brother comes along and goes, thank God for that. And he would have been furious with me if I got rid of that cabinet. He doesn't want it, but it belongs to the tribe. And that is exactly tribal thinking. That's how the family feels. So if you've got up and started investigating spiritual work that's not in the tribe, their faces will be like my family's on Christmas lunch when I told them I was being ordained. Their jaws hit the floor. They couldn't understand why. They really just couldn't. And my brother said, I don't know what to say. And my friend Bernadette, bless her, who was having lunch with us, said, you say congratulations. That's what you say. Wonderful, feisty woman, my friend Bernadette. I wouldn't have dared say that. Bernadette's an inspiration, I have to say. So the story's all about how we are afraid of the consequences of stepping up and stepping out. And we have to learn to walk through that fear, that which is why it's so good that Anita Diamond wrote The Red Tent, because she's updated the story and given it an ending which is not about woundology. Caroline Macy's word woundology is when we stay in that side tribe and go on moaning and complaining and grumbling. Yes, it was awful what happened to us. What happened to you, what happened to me, what happened to Bill, what happened to Don, what happened to any one of us here. Things have happened to us that were awful. We acknowledge that, we grieve, we hate, we rage, and then we realise we have to get up and walk on. Because if we don't get up and walk on, we will stay locked in that resentment and hatred. And that's one of the problems that women have had over the generations, is we have felt trapped and we've got tied up in resentment and hatred. And then we became manipulators, which is another reason why we ended up being hated. We have got a chance in the modern world of changing this dynamic. We could be like Lysistrata, I can never pronounce that, from the Greek play. We could say to all the menfolk, no more cooking, no more food, no more comfort, no more sex until you stop going to war. And we would win. But we won't do it. And we have to ask ourselves why. And finally, at the metaphysical level, it's to teach us that humanity will always fight the other at the level of yesod. Unless we can accept diversity and paradox and understand that we can hold two aspects in our hand at the same time, we will continue to demonize the other and refuse to accept even their offers of an olive branch of peace. Right, I'm going to stop there and pause for a minute for you to pour out your, oh my God, that's a terrible stories, if you want to, which I would quite agree with. And any thoughts, comments, questions? Yes, Bill.
I was going to say to the people present, get the opportunity, if it comes around, or alternatively locate it on Google, to see the film Yentl, Yentl. It's set in Eastern Europe, 1904, and it's all about a girl who wants to have the privileges of a boy in being able to study the oral Torah. And she's blocked off at every turn. After her father actually encourages her. But at that time, it starts off actually with the books that are coming around. Story books for girls, prayer book, study books for men. prayer books for, sorry, story books for girls, study books for men. And she gets her, wants to take a study book, and the first year refused to send it away until she tells it for her father. But it's all about how she finds her independence by posing as a boy and enrolling in a yeshiva and being able to study all law. It's a fascinating film, Barbara Streisand.
Yes, I saw it many years ago. Thank you for reminding me.
You may, sometimes, if you go into Google, you can actually pick up the film itself. Mm. I've done that with one or two films.
Yes, it's a step in progress. Because at the end of it, she does marry, and she marries a husband who wants her to continue with her studies. But again, it's still from the permission of the man.
It's, no. She doesn't marry.
Doesn't she? I beg your pardon.
No. She does, actually, she gets married, but falsely to the girl who has rejected his friend, her friend, because his brother had committed suicide. It's rather a little bit complicated.
Okay, we'll have to stop there. We'll have to stop there because we're going to run out of time otherwise. But thank you. Yeah, Yentl. It's an interesting movie for sure. Thank you. Okay. Any more thoughts or comments, or shall we move on weeping? Another thing too. I completely forgotten. In the United Kingdom, a woman couldn't have her own bank account until 1975. Unless she had the permission of her husband or father. 1975. We have come a long way since the 1970s, and I think it's worth really celebrating that.
Unfortunately, lots of the rest of the world hasn't.
I know they haven't, Sally, but we've got to lead from the front and teach. I know. Again, the best criticism of the bad is the practice of the better and teaching it on. So, the story of Joseph. Joseph is the first son of Rachel and Jacob. Joseph and Jacob were Rachel's children, and basically they were Jacob's favourites because he loved Rachel. Joseph represents, the whole story is the perfecting of Yesod. So it's a really important story for the Kabbalist. It's the foundation. And Joseph is the child of Tiferet because Jacob, who's known as Israel, is placed at Tiferet on the Tree of Life. And Joseph is his son. And Joseph is a dreamer. A lot of the story is about dreams, which is images, Yetzeratic images, and the interpretation of dreams and images. And there's also a certain amount about sexuality in it, which is also Yesodic, and also that coat of many colours. Well, that's pure Yesod image, except it wasn't a coat of many colours. Nowhere in the Bible does it say he has a coat of many colours. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. It's Chthonis Passim, which means a fine wool or linen tunic, a long robe with sleeves, with ornaments. And it actually could be the equivalent of something like symbolic of the high priest's garment, which had ornaments on it. But whatever it was an outfit with sleeves, and it was long, and only wealthy and important people wore long robes. Jesus would never have worn a long robe or a toga in his life, but he's always depicted as having done so. So, the story starts when Joseph's 17. Now, most 17-year-olds are prats. I know I was a 17-year-old prat, and an awful lot of young men are prats at 17, and quite a few young women too. And Joseph has no filters. He's a spoilt brat, if you like. So, first of all, he sneaks to his father about the behaviour of his brothers. That's not going to make him popular. I remember my father once wonderfully finding out that I'd disobeyed him and gone ice skating with a friend on a Saturday night. My God, I was wicked in those days. And her mother found out and phoned up my dad and said, "Your daughter and my daughter have disobeyed us. You must punish your daughter." And my father came up to my bedroom. I was about to go to bed and said, "I don't like disobedience, but I like sneaks even less. Don't do it again. no punishment, and walked out. And I really respected him for that. Sneaks are not good news. And then Joseph had dreams about his brothers, and like a prune, he told them. He saw that his sheaf was upright and stronger than his brothers, and his brothers' sheaves bowed down to Joseph's sheep. This is one of the youngest boys in the tribe. You can imagine how they took that. And we know that these are not very nice men. And dream number two, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars in the skies that they knew of bowed to Joseph. So Joseph is not going to be popular. He's going around basically going, hello stars, hello sky, look at me, I'm the loved one, I'm very, very favoured and everybody loves me. And they didn't. So he is forced out because the one that doesn't fit and the one who's arrogant is going to be expelled. And he did misuse that dream. Those dreams, that knowledge of that dream. He should have kept that into himself and used it to strive to become a better person and worthy of the high office that he was going to have. But he was 17. And the misuse of Yesod means that you will try to shine before you're ready. And we do this when we start learning to be healers or homeopaths or whatever. We quite often run before we can walk. And we make silly mistakes and we get into trouble. I'm talking about myself again, but I suspect you can identify. So the brothers intend to throw him down a well to die. Reuben, however, says, don't do it, don't do it. And he manages to persuade the other brothers not to execute Joseph. But Judah, one of the other elder brothers, Leah's son, both of them, sells Joseph into slavery. So Joseph becomes the overseer for the captain of Pharaoh's guard in Egypt. Well, that's actually a pretty high position. That's not too bad. But he's lost everything through the misuse of Yesod. The next story is about Potiphar's wife. Again, Yesod is the gonadic chakra, the temptations of sex. And Potiphar's wife wants to seduce Joseph. She fancies him. And then when he won't give in to her, good old Joseph, he says no, he doesn't fancy her, he doesn't want to do this, knows that it's wrong. She grabs hold of his cloak and takes hold of the cloak and keeps the cloak and uses it as evidence that he tried to rape her. So she cries attempted rape. So we've actually got exactly the opposite of the Dinah story. We've got a young person who says no, and the other one yelling rape. So you can see there is a sort of odd parallel opposite going on here. And of course, Potiphar believes his wife and Joseph goes to jail. Now, Yesod is always about repeating patterns, but it can learn. When it has access to Tiferet and being thrown into jail gives you lots of access to Tiferet. Look at Nelson Mandela, who could have come out deeply embittered and came out a transformed man and a great leader. The Lord was with Joseph, and the jailer showed him kindness, and the prison warder liked him and put him in charge of all those held in the prison. So Joseph has obviously got some charisma about him. And suddenly the dreams come back. Two of the men who've been thrown into the jail have dreams, and they want interpretations. And Joseph is starting to learn humility. This is the point that Yesod needs to learn humility. Joseph had arrogance. He's been in jail long enough to say, do not interpretations belong to God? He's obviously in touch with God, and he's becoming a servant of the Holy One. So the two dreams, the chief cupbearer has a dream that says, I saw a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. As soon as it budded, it blossomed, and its clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes, squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and put the cup in his hand. And Joseph interpreted the dream to say, well, within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your position. And it came true. The second dream, before the cupbearer goes back, Joseph does a little yes-odded thing, which we would all do, but shows that he's not quite enlightened yet. He says, when you go back, please remember me and mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of here. because I was stolen away out of the land of the Hebrews, and also have I done nothing that they should put me in the dungeon. So he's putting the condition on it, very, very natural, but still Yesod. And of course, the cupbearer, who also lives in Yesod, completely neglects to do what Joseph asked him to. The other guy in the jail is the baker, the chief baker of Pharaoh. His dream was, on my head there were three baskets of bread. In the top basket there were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, but the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. And Joseph's interpretation was, well, within 3 days you're going to be hanged on a tree and the birds will eat away your flesh. I don't suppose that one went down very well, but it was accurate. But at least Joseph is using his ability, his yesodic ability to dream, to be as helpful as he can be for another. So Joseph stays in jail another 2 years to reflect and to meditate and to contemplate. And 2 years later, Pharaoh has a dream. And the dream is there that 7 cows came from the fire in the Nile, fat and sleek, and other that ugly and gaunt 7 cows that ate up the 7 sleek fat cows. And then he slept again about 7 heads of grain and a parallel dream that's on the PowerPoint for you. And in the morning he sent for the magicians and the wise men, and no one could interpret them. And then the chief cupbearer remembers Jacob. So Jacob goes to in front of Pharaoh and says quite clearly, it is not in me, God shall give Pharaoh a sound answer. That is Yesod working to Tiferet, working in the kingdom of heaven, saying, all power that comes to me comes from the Holy One. And he interprets it for Pharaoh to say that there are going to be 7 good years of abundance. So collect all the food of those good years that are coming, store up plenty of grain and hold it in reserve, because the following 7 years will be famine. So just take care that you aren't ruined by the famine. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made all this known to you, there is no one as discerning and wise as you, and you should be in charge of my palace. And I, only in respect to the throne will I be greater than you. And took his signet ring and put it on Joseph's finger, dresses him in robes of fine linen. Again, we come to the robes. Yes, it is always image. It's how you're clothed, how you present yourself, what other people see in your persona or your masks. So Joseph has basically had a magnificent robe, had it torn away from him and been thrown into slavery, and then had another good robe put on him and had that taken away from him. But now he's accepted that he is not in charge, that God is in charge and that his life is being directed. He is given another good robe and a gold chain around his neck. Now, Joseph marries an Egyptian, so Joseph marries out of the tribe, and oh boy, the commentaries don't like that. They go round in circles trying to explain how he could do that, and they came up with the idea that Joseph married Dinah's daughter by Shechem, so she was technically a Jewess, so it's all right. But there you go. That's the way it goes. But he did marry an Egyptian. This is important. Moses marries out of the tribe as well. And one of the glorious things about the Hebrew text is when you get beyond Torah, when you get to the books of Ruth and Esther and Judges, you'll see that most of the women there are either outside the tribe or only marry into the tribe. Those women are absolute flag bearers for the teaching that the other is not your enemy. You must hold to your integrity and honor the integrity of the other. This happens again and again and again. So Joseph has 2 sons called Manasseh and Ephraim, who become part of the tribe of Israel. And then the famine comes. 7 years, Joseph's in power and it's good years, and then the famine comes. And guess what? The Canaanites, Jacob and all the others, are subject to the famine. So Jacob, now called Israel, go down to Egypt to buy grain because they need it. Benjamin, the youngest, Rachel's youngest son, we don't know how old he was, stays behind. And of course, they don't recognize Joseph. Why would they? It's at least, it's probably 15 years since they threw him down the well. This is a full-grown man and a wise man. And Joseph recognises them, but they don't know who he is. So basically, Jacob plays a game with him. Plays a game, puts on a mask. He says, no. Well, he first of all says, yes, of course you can have whatever you want. And he tricks them by giving them grain, but putting their money back in the sacks so that they will look like they are thieves. And they are called back, and Joseph says to them, you are going to be my servants now, basically. Simeon is thrown into jail because that's his karma for what he's part of what he did to Dinah and what he did to Joseph. And then Joseph says to them, okay, you can go, but I want you to bring back your youngest brother who will be my slave. He's asking for his own brother. They don't know that. And confused, the brothers go back home, knowing that they can have only got their freedom on condition that they bring Benjamin back with them. They're very distressed. And Reuben says to them, didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy, meaning Joseph, but you wouldn't listen. Now we must give an accounting for his blood. And Joseph overhears them saying that because he's using an interpreter. So he sets them up beautifully. And then they go back to Jacob and say, we have to take Benjamin down to the overseer of Egypt. And Jacob is heartbroken. You've deprived me of my children. Joseph's no more. Simeon is no more. He's held back in Egypt by Joseph. And now you want to take Benjamin. Everything's against him. And then Reuben steps up and becomes more honourable. He was a little bit honourable anyway because he didn't want Joseph to be killed. But he says, you may put both of my sons to death if I don't bring Benjamin back to you. Entrust him to my care. I will bring him back. He knows he has to take him to Joseph, but he will bring him back. And that sacrifice which he offers is not required because he was opposed to the expulsion or death of Joseph. And then Judah says to Israel, his father, send the boy along with me and I will go. We will go at once so that we and you and our children may live and not die. I myself will guarantee his safety. You can hold me personally responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him here before you, I will bear the blame before you all my life. He is accepting that he may lose his life. This is his karma. So they take Benjamin down with them. Joseph is delighted to see them, gives them all the grain they could possibly want, and then send them back. And this is the point at which he puts the silver in their bags so that they will be afraid. And Judah had guaranteed the boy's safety, but when the silver is found in the sacks, because Joseph, of course, sends people straight after them to find them and takes them back, he says, right, Benjamin is now my slave. And Judah goes to Joseph and says, please let me remain here as my Lord's slave in place of the boy and let the boy return with his brothers. So this is stepping up and becoming honourable. All is about becoming honourable. And then Joseph demonstrates that he has perfected his yesod. Yes, he has been mean to them, but frankly, how can you blame him? He says, I'm your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then it was not you who sent me here, but God. That is the revelation that lifts us out of yesod into our true self, out of our false self of yesod, which is that everything does happen for a reason. And the terrible things that seem to happen can, if we will respond to them rather than reacting to them, end up in good. So although it's a fairly terrible story, and it's all a very terrible story, this one at least is giving us a way of working, understanding how we start out as careless and wicked and bad. But through the process of making those mistakes, we can learn the humility of understanding that if we will let go and let God, we will be helped through this. In a way, it's a sort of early version of crucifixion, because Jesus on the cross has to let go. He has to say, Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. Into thy hands I commend my spirit. And gives up. He doesn't fight, he doesn't campaign, he doesn't resist. He gives up and allows God's work. And that is the purpose of crucifixion, not the hanging on the cross, not the suffering, but the dying to the problem. That's what forgiveness is all about. It's not about condoning. You don't let the person get away with it, but you have to let go of your holding on to the grief and anger that it caused. Because if you hold on to it, you are re-inflicting that pain on yourself every day. And the other person's just gone off and doesn't care anymore. They don't mind. They're not hurting them by your lack of forgiveness, but you are hurting yourself. So the Hebrews all moved down to Egypt, and Israel, formerly Jacob, shows that he's learnt something too, because he stole his birthright from Esau, but he sees that Joseph's second son is the right one to receive the birthright. So unlike his father Isaac, who is blind, either psychologically or physically, Israel has shown that he's awake and understands that the blessing is not given tribally to the eldest, it is given to the one who deserves it and who will work with it. So Joseph says, no, 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 take the firstborn. And Jacob says, no, I know it. He shall also be great, but truly the younger brother shall be greater than he. So we've now come to the end of this brutal teaching journal. It really is a journal of teaching for us, if we can take it that way. And some conclusions I've come up with, but I'm sure you'll have more, which we start with the tree of knowledge. We are still eating from it today. And when we eat from it, we make the other the enemy, we blame the other, we practice division, because the tree of knowledge is our opinion of what is good and what is evil. We've learned that the tribe is not always the best ethical of places. In fact, it can be positively wicked. And the reason why is because it believes it's right. Because the tribe is always eating from the tree of knowledge and says, we're the ones who are right. If we try to leave the tribe, we've learned that it may want to exile us or kill us. I've been exiled from 2 tribes now, possibly 3. And every time I've been exiled, it's been the most amazing thing. Hurt like hell at the time. Utterly, viciously horrible at the time. But the third time it happened, which was really quite recently, it took me an hour to turn it round. So I'm really quite proud of myself, sorry to tell you that, but I'm really quite chuffed about the fact I thought, okay, this is a release. This is meaning God needs me to go in a new direction. Okay, where do you want me to go? And that's the most amazing feeling. We've also learned that karma will find us. If you go back over these stories again in your own time, you'll find karma. Karma's a bitch. Karma comes along and it will find us. And also karma is relieved. There is good karma as well. And when you read the stories of the women in the Hebrew Testament, you'll find the karma going round the generations and being healed. All the way up to Deborah, Yael, Esther and Hannah is the return of good karma. And also that the divine feminine is there, but it's hidden as it should be. And also that taking the wider view from Tiferet, from our true self, where we have access to the Holy One, can turn even the wrong into the right. But that means that we have to use free will. Courage is French for, is courage of the heart, which means lifting ourselves up to the level of the heart, being willing to let go of the tribal preconceptions. And finally, next time, we're going to go to Exodus, which is the hero's journey, as Sally so accurately said, which is totally about all of us. So that's Genesis. You may say goodbye and good riddance. Any thoughts, comments, questions? No? No? Okay. Yes, Bill.
one tiny point. Earlier on, you were talking about the three divisions, Torah,
Prophets and Wisdom Prophets, books. Yeah,
and Wisdom. Of course, the Torah, strictly speaking, is actually the five books of Moses, although it can be used as a very generic term for all teachings. But strictly speaking, of course, it is the five books of Moses. And the Torah scroll used in synagogue is specifically the five books of Moses. That's all.
It is, yes. And actually, once you get into Prophets and the Wisdom books, you'll find an awful lot that was written at First Temple times or for the belief of First Temple times. And that's why you're going to find the Divine Feminine in those. Because unfortunately, the books of Moses, whether it's just editing or whether they were, are the real primary patriarchal books. Yes, Sally?
Just an extra about Prophets, because there's what, 49 Prophets and 42 are men and seven, let's say you've got Sarah, Miriam, Deborah, Abigail, Huldah, Esther, and Hannah, I think, is the seventh.
Yeah.
Prophetesses. Possibly because they're more powerful, and possibly because they each represent a Sephira.
Absolutely. They're each placed on the Sephira. And Esther, what even Warren said this, Esther is the first known female Messiah. Because Warren taught, and Kabbalah teaches, that there's always a Messiah alive in the world in every generation. The Messianic presence can last for 3 days, 3 years, 3 months. You can grow into it and you can hold it for a second. You do not have to be Jewish, but there is always one person who is that anointed of the Holy One and many helpers there to help them. And there will have been feminine Messiahs before Esther, but she's the first known one.
Actually, strictly speaking, the 36.
What?
The adoption of the 36 just men in every generation.
That's right, yes.
If there weren't those 36 just men, the world would collapse.
Yes, and also I think it's 70 Zadikim to support them.
Mm.
But there is also one who's sitting on the top of the heap, apparently.
Yeah,
but right. Usually a Messianic presence is hidden. They do the work quietly in the back streets, because we know what happens if you don't.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to stop the recording now.